Hi, welcome to Info Dumpies. My name's Brianne. I'm autistic, I have ADHD, my pronouns are she, her, and I am Fist McOrifice, first of her name. Paladin, sworn to my god Hitachi of the magic wands. Slayer of the G-spot and nemesis of anorgasmia of the SSRI.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Wow. That was impressive. Hi, I'm Violet. I have ADHD. My pronouns are she, her. And I was just going to say, I used to be a professional dungeon master. That was my little fun fact. Back, COVID kind of killed it, but all that cool stuff too, also about me.
Well, I don't know if it helps, but mine's all bullshit I just pulled out of my butt.
Oh, yeah. It's the character you're playing.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, not like my usual character.
In case you couldn't tell, today I want to talk about Dungeons & Dragons, or more specifically, where it came from. Like, where, not just Dungeons & Dragons, but where tabletop role-playing games came from. How did that become a thing? Where did that originate? And how do we go from the very first example of something like that to modern Dungeons and Dragons? The roots of role-playing games start in what we would call wargaming, but even further than that, they can be traced back to ancient strategy games, like a game you might have heard of called the Royal Game of Ur and Chaturanga, which are from Mesopotamia and India, respectively.
I've heard of Chaturanga. I had not heard of this game of Ur until you were like, James, you gotta play this shit. And James is like, I don't think I like this from the video you saw.
Oh,
so you showed me.
The Royal Game of Ur is actually a separate game than Nine Men's Morris, which is also, that comes from ancient Rome.
Oh, that's the other one you had. Okay,
yeah,
so
yeah,
you
yeah.
got a lot of good names. That's right. The name was Nine Men's Morris, which is very funny.
Yeah. Nine Men's Morris, by the way, is a board game that comes from at least ancient Rome, if not older. And all of these games, Chaturanga, Ur, and Nine Men's Morris, they're all essentially strategy games. And you are basically trying to get more pieces than your opponent. Kind of like chess. Chess was also a strategy game originally. Obviously, there's knights and bishops and
now.
Pawns. And it wasn't used to be. It still is a strategy game. It's the most popular strategy game. For a long time, things like Ur and Chaturanga and even Nine Men's Morris were just as popular, or in some places more popular, than chess. So I even thought about doing a whole episode just on ancient board games, but that's, I think, going to be a different episode. Those early strategy games were adapted by some cultures. There's not one specific rule set. A lot of people were like, I like playing it this way, I like playing it that way. Some cultures took this a step further by adding theatrical elements. In ancient Han China, nobles would play games of military skill where they would, quote, take pleasure in dressing up and acting the part of a commander.
So it's LARPing.
LARPing, exactly. So
it's LARPing. LARPing was the original.
Kind of, yeah. Around 70 AD, the Romans started doing massive role-playing events, kind of like LARPs, exactly what you said.
It's like a LARP meetup, yeah.
Yeah, and they were basically in scale with the Colosseum. And a lot of that sort of thing probably happened in the Colosseum after it was built.
Except the Colosseum was like, what if we actually started killing the people involved?
Oh, yeah. It was much darker. Yeah. They would do war games
LARPing
in the Colosseum, but they would also do just straight up to the death battle. They would also do, you know, large historical reenactments there. In this case, the actors were not really willing participants. They were more slaves and prisoners forced into their roles rather than professional soldiers told to actually fight each other.
That's why. So I thought, like, part of me thought that the historical reenactments were a racist person's vestiges of the very short-lived Confederate South. While that is true, historical reenactments are much, much older, and people have been doing them for a long time. I just didn't consider it. Because anytime I think of people doing historical reenactments, I think being from the South, I'm like, oh, yeah.
No, that makes sense. Yeah.
Like, for me, that is almost synonymous with Civil War reenactors.
Well, there's actually a long history of this. This is essentially where the roots of modern role-playing games come from. when we look at the Middle Ages, we had things like tournaments, jousts, melees, etc. All of those originally began as battle practice to hone warrior skills. They eventually evolved into highly theatrical events filled with pageantry, as many things in the medieval era did. And all of this was influenced heavily, very much, by the Arthurian romance literature of the time. Knights would wear colorful garments to show their loyalty, and it's all very...
I've been to medieval times.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's all very medieval times.
It's a one-for-one, I'm sure.
I think they took some notes. Yeah, they must have taken some notes from medieval times.
Nothing's inaccurate.
Exactly.
I've seen A Knight's Tale. I got it.
Yeah, but there's like, medieval times gets the flavor of what they were doing to a degree. You generally wouldn't have like a turkey leg on a plate in your thing. I don't know what they served in medieval. Maybe turkey
probably
legs.
Probably something gross.
Yeah, probably.
From what I understand of medieval food, probably something gross out of necessity because that's what they had.
Yeah, probably bread with some sand mixed in it because that was kind of unavoidable.
And it's a little bit of ergot in there to trip you up.
Just a little bit. The most notable example of these events is probably from Edward III of England, who would regularly hold tournaments where he and his personal guard would dress up as famous knights of the round table. Yes, the same ones that you are aware of from fairy tales and whatnot. And they would basically LARP, like almost the same thing, just without the numbers, right? They're not talking about hit points and things, but they would just kind of wing it.
So rich guy forces his employees to LARP with him.
Yes, almost exactly. And Edward III was a huge fan of that. He would do that a lot, specifically as the Knights of the Round Table. This continued for a long time. And in 1468, Charles the Bold, the Duke of Burgundy, held a tournament that was very extravagant. This is where we start to get into like almost escape room like elements, because... Oh. This time, in this tournament, the environment was meticulously crafted with golden trees that were hung with the attending knight's coats of arms.
Holy shit.
Yeah. An attending noble, who was like a visitor, like a guest star, basically, named Anthony of Luxembourg, was locked in a tower that could only be opened by a golden key that they had to find.
And then from out behind one of the suits of armor comes a little man in a pinstripe suit who says, "I've been here the whole time."
Basically, yeah, honestly.
That's some game changer shit.
So this was very popular for a long time. Eventually, it started to branch out not just in terms of warfare and battles and things like that, but it started to kind of merge with theater, because obviously theater at this point has been going on for a long time as well. The creation of essentially dynamic, interactive characters in theater started to develop between the 16th and 18th centuries with the emergence of what they call commedia dell'arte in Italy. And this is a form of theater that relied entirely on improvisational acting, no scripts, and they utilized stock characters, so like stereotype-based characters that take on over-the-top, exaggerated qualities for comedic effect. The rich old guy, the nosy servant, the cowardly military commander, and...
The Harlequin, which is the modern inspiration for Harley Quinn, like her costume and everything, the original Bruce Timlin.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. That was a stereotype role sort of character. This is also similar, and I don't know if you made this connection, to Japanese kabuki theater. That was something that it kind of rung a bell for me, because for those of you who don't know, kabuki theater, they use different like types of face paint and specific patterns, or sometimes even masks, in particular designs to indicate who the character is supposed to be. For example, if you see a character that has like a lot of red around their eyes and big dynamic angled eyebrows, they're telling you they're supposed to be a really angry person through the expression that's painted on their face. That's like their character. And that's a common character you'll see in multiple different plays, that same type of face paint. So it's like messaging to the audience, which I think is really interesting that they started doing that in a very visual sense in kabuki.
Yeah. And being an acting nerd, it's really interesting how a lot of early theater, like, acting itself is changed. So that is in line with the acting that would come after, where the idea was you needed to just be fucking heard by the people in this big place, and you needed to be able to do that, and you needed to be ostentatious enough in your portrayals of these things that people could understand if you were angry from the back row.
Exactly.
Which was not easy in these regards when feelings have so much nuance. So things like Kabuki theater and Commedia dell'arte, when you have these stock characters, it took some of the pressure off of the actors to necessarily say, hey, you feel this way, because the audience is trained to say, well, the person is wearing blank. The person has blank makeup. I can see that from back here. So whenever they're speaking, that's angry, guys. So I interpret that as angry because I can't really see the face from over here.
Interesting. I didn't realize that that's what the purpose of that was, but it makes a lot of sense. If you can't easily convey the feeling of the character, you know, viewable space of the actor, right? That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Moving into the 19th and 20th centuries, we start to get role-playing more accessible to the general public through what they called parlor games, especially in the UK and sometimes in North America. We didn't call them really parlor games as much here. Board games, more like. I think modern, I should clarify. We call them board games now, but back in the day, it was just kind of games in the North America. What we're talking about essentially is board games, or the kind of games you might play in school with your friends, if you have an idea of that, right?
I thought you were going to say if you had friends.
Assuming you had friends in school.
Assuming the kind of games. Friends.
Yeah. A good example of this, I don't know if you've heard of this game, but I have. It's called Consequences. Does that ring a bell for you at all?
No, it sounds scary.
Oh, no, it's not scary at all. So I don't know why it's called Consequences, to be fully honest.
I don't like that. That's scary.
No, it's not scary. It's a game where you write a sentence and then you pass it to another person and then they write the next sentence of the story. So it's collaborative storytelling.
Oh, why the hell they name it Consequences?
I don't know. That's just what I've heard it called. But you're literally just basically passing a piece of paper around and adding a line to the story one by one by one by one. It's a fun little game. There were a lot of parlor games inspired by that sort of thing. Consequences, of course, being originally a parlor game that is still around today. In the 1920s and 30s, these games started to evolve to have some level of like tactical decision making. So it's not so much about acting like entertainment side of the improv. It's more into the winning game side of things, winning, losing game.
What decisions can you make on the spot?
Exactly.
As far as strategy.
Yeah. A notable example of this that I found from 1937, which is one of the early like box parlor games, essentially, is a game called Jury Box. Jury Box asks players to solve six cases while acting as the members of the jury. Sounds kind of like a modern role-playing game.
Yeah, that's exactly what that sounds like.
Exactly. It relied heavily on paying attention and interpreting the evidence. And this was way before we had D&D's release, but we still had people sitting around a table playing characters and rolling dice on a shared story.
I would argue that is exactly the first box tabletop RPG.
Yeah, kind of. Now, it's important to mention you are members of the jury deciding over evidence. So you're not necessarily like taking on a persona. You are yourself as a member of the jury.
You are yourself pretending that you have jury duty on this trial. Yeah.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
Still.
You are playing the role of a juror, but also yourself. So it's like, it's role play, but in like almost the loosest sense. I mean, well, it's definitely role play. I don't know. I'm a little iffy on it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. If we're talking, okay, I don't mean, it's not like I'm just taking this here, but if that doesn't count, then I think a lot of people's sexual role play wouldn't count either, because some people are playing themselves, but in different situations, and we would still call that role play.
That's true. No, you got me there. So yeah, I think that solidly concludes. It's role play. From there, we get into war gaming. This is kind of a return to form, I guess, for lack of a better term, for the ancient LARPing role play stuff that was going on. When we talk about wargaming, we're talking about you are playing essentially the role of a general and you have an army of little soldiers. Oftentimes, this is like hundreds of soldiers. And a good example of this in modern day would be something like Warhammer 40K. I'm sure you've heard that name before, probably more than you even care for.
Yep.
I'll be honest, I'm not a Warhammer 40K fan. I think the world is just too grimdark. Everyone is a bad guy in some way, shape, or form. But it is a war game. It's a very popular war game. You spend an exorbitant amount of money on little plastic dollies. Characters, on little baby dollies. In Warhammer, you have kits of little baby guys, little characters that you can take out of the box and you can paint them and put them on little stands and stuff. And you are basically building an army from individual pieces. And each of those kits and sometimes individual pieces have a point value. Generally, when you are playing Warhammer, you're going against two armies of an equal point value. So I build a 300 point army, you build a 300 point army, we set up a terrain, and then we put our guys on the field and go from there.
Too much stuff for me.
Yeah, same. It's a bit much for me, because imagine if you're playing D&D and you're controlling like 200 characters that can only do one thing every turn.
And I think I just lack the executive function to find setting up all of that and taking all of that apart to be entertainment. I think I would be like, this is nice, but I have a chore when I'm done.
One of the things that is very similar for wargaming, like as an issue that is a problem with it for me, is that I can't solve a puzzle in one sitting if it's a complicated enough puzzle to entertain
It would be out for a while.
It's going to be out for a while.
Yeah.
And not only that, but the amount of work you have to do to get to a point where you can actually play Warhammer, like the full game. There's accessible versions of Warhammer that are smaller groups, like 100 point armies, one single box. You just take them out of the box and play if you don't want to paint them. And I think in some cases you can just pay people to paint them for you, really. But that gets really expensive. There's a weird stigma that I noticed with Warhammer, especially, where people did not want to play with you if you don't have your pieces painted, which I think is a little bit silly because paint is expensive. Warhammer paint is so expensive. I don't want to spend hundreds of hours painting my little guy army.
It's a psyop from big Warhammer to get you to buy more paint.
I'm not a huge fan of Warhammer, but wargaming is essentially that. It was not as complicated when we look at the original versions of wargaming. The first example of this is a thing called Kriegsspiel, which is a 19th century Prussian war game that was actually intended for use for military training. It has its own very, very niche fan base nowadays as like just a game, but the goal of that originally was to teach military strategy. And it worked in a similar manner, albeit much simpler and more rudimentary to modern wargaming.
Not in outer space.
Not in outer space. This also took some inspiration from H.G. Wells's 1913 book Little Wars, at least more modern wargaming did, which adapted miniature toy soldiers battles for civilians. And in the late 1960s, there was a group of history students and wargaming enthusiasts at the University of Minnesota, where we live, which formed the Midwest Military Simulation Association, or MMSA. And this group, MMSA, included future gaming pioneers such as David Wesley and Dave Arneson, who would later become very integral into the creation of modern tabletop role-playing games, would regularly meet to play complex, large-scale historical battle simulations, the starting point of how we get to modern D&D. People like Dave Arneson and David Wesley, and I'm going to get to Gary Gygax, but he's not a good dude. I have some quotes from Gary. No, I have some quotes from him later.
Bad, man.
But he and several other people were very crucial into developing modern tabletop role-playing games. Before D&D was able to formalize tabletop role-playing games, there's actually something else called Bronstein. Bronstein was created by David Wesley, who I mentioned earlier. So Bronstein is set in a fictional German town during the Napoleonic era, and the game shifted the focus of wargaming from players controlling massive armies to actually controlling individual characters with specific, often non-military jobs. So, for example, you could be the town mayor, the banker, the university chancellor was a role that you could play. Sounds pretty boring. I'd rather be like an elf rogue or something. But
yeah, yeah.
The interesting part of this is the way Bronstein works is you have one character who is the referee, and the characters in... Yeah, I know. you're squinting at me. And yeah, referee.
Referee.
So the way Bronstein works, you're supposed to only talk to the referee.
Oh.
Yeah. And then the referee tells you what happens. And then, yeah, that was super weird. And I think people started to realize, well, if I'm the baker and you're the
university chancellor, why wouldn't the baker talk to the university chancellor at all?
I need bread.
I'm on my lunch break. Let me talk to God to ask God if you can give me a sandwich.
Basically, honestly, yeah, that's kind of how it worked, right? You were trying to do your role in the town as best as you could, and you were basically talking to the referee to see how well you did it. But people playing their characters just kind of realized, well, I'm just going to talk to this person. The referee would be like, well, you're not there. Well, I'm going to go there. So you can very quickly see.
People helped make it into a better game by saying this mechanic doesn't work.
Exactly. Yeah. It was kind of like if you're familiar with the concept of like desire paths in like city infrastructure, they said, it makes more sense to me intuitively.
Just go straight to the baker. Just go straight to the baker. Why would I go around here to do that? Yeah.
Exactly. There's actually a quote here. Wesley expected players to communicate solely with him as the referee, but they unexpectedly began using their characters to talk to one another and traveled around the town. Basically means no one person invented role play, which I think is lovely.
I think, right? Yeah, it's in the spirit of things.
Yeah, yeah. The concept of D&D where you are playing a singular character, role playing as someone, and someone else is also, and you're playing a game together, that was almost as organic as it could be.
Well, and I think, not to wax poetic about it too much, but when you're talking about the earliest role play game stuff, it made me think of, oh, my little baby autistic ass making sure everyone had very specific roles when we played make-believe and followed specific rules for what they were doing, and me getting upset saying, no, we can't have two pink Power Rangers. You have to be somebody else. That's not how this works. I think humans just do that, too. Yeah. Like, I think it's an innate thing we do to play make-believe together.
Yeah, it's something that we do to help make sense of the world and, you know, understand our roles in society.
And I think tabletop RPG has just created explicit boundaries for that help us explore that more as adults, which I think is really cool. I like tabletop RPG. And like, speaking of talking character, it's so funny that was initially the concept was you only talk to the referee.
Right. Imagine D&D. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking our last session, there was one time I was so lost in the sauce this last Friday that I was talking in my character voice to you like you're an NPC. And then everyone's like, is Brienne talking to the DM or is your character? I was like, I plumb forgot that she was an NPC right now. I'm just lost talking in this voice. All right.
You went full method.
Yeah, I went full method. I was like, I am the goblin bard jorking to peanuts right now.
The concept of one-to-one identification between player and character rather than a player as a general controlling an army was pretty inspirational to the people that played the game and were like, hey, there's something here. This is really interesting. One of the people that was involved in that, named Dwayne Jenkins, created a Wild West spinoff where the players were given their own player characters with a story that they could develop from game to game. You have a character sheet. Yes, which birthed the continuous campaign. Because typically, Bronstein, for example, was like a one-session thing, and you were playing yourself as a role. This was, you were playing someone else.
Rattlesnake Jenkins.
Exactly. Soon after that, Dave Arneson used these concepts to create the Blackmoor fantasy setting in 1971, which subsequently served as the mechanical and conceptual framework for Dungeons and Dragons. released just a year after the original Dungeons & Dragons in 1975, there was a game called Empire of the Petal Throne, which is like, whoa, already into the elaborate names.
Yeah.
Because you have Dungeons and Dragons, and now we have Empire of the Petal Throne, right? It's a bit of a leap. It's very fitting, though, because Empire of the Petal Throne is where we kind of saw that RPGs could really be elaborate, highly original settings. It doesn't have to be Tolkien again, again, again. Because at this point, you know, there was already people going, oh, well, let me do Knights of the Round Table. Let me do elves and gnomes and goblins and dwarves. Tolkien had been around for, you know, decades at this point. An ancient languages professor at the university named M.A.R. Barker created a setting called Tekumel, which is a world that he had apparently been developing for decades. And this diverged highly from the Tolkien stuff that we talked about. It's a vibrant, brutal sci-fi mix of like Indian, Egyptian, Mesoamerican culture and stuff. And it is set on a distant planet 60,000 years in the future.
Whoa.
But the players are humans that are, they're in the setting and they're quickly cast into another dimension, which leaves them with highly advanced technological artifacts, and the people from 60,000 years in the future assume that the technology from the other dimension is magic.
I don't want to offer this guy unsolicited critique.
It's a little
The first word that came to my mind was convoluted.
Yeah, it's a little convoluted. You'll be pretty delighted to learn, I bet, that he even created a fully functional conlang called, I believe, Solyani for the game, which is really, really cool.
Yeah, it's really cool when people create conlangs for art things they're making. And it's really cool when people do that, and everyone should think it's cool.
It's cool and hot. It's cool and hot, cool. And it's something that only hot people do.
Thank you.
Oh, are you also doing that?
Yeah,
I know, I'm just scooping on you. Yeah, it's a really cool setting, and it was really the first time that we had something that totally was an RPG, but fully departed from the Tolkien lore that almost every
previous
RPG was.
Yeah, I respect that.
RPG
it's convoluted, but I respect the attempt.
And I should mention also, about the same time as D&D, there was an honorable mention, there was a system called, I believe, Chainmail. I don't even have it in my notes, but I just know this off the top of my head. There's a system called Chainmail, which was the essentially predecessor to D&D, and it was more about calculating accurate battle damage on a one-on-one basis for wargaming.
Oh, not interested. No, thank you.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. That basically morphed into Dungeons & Dragons as we know it. But I say Dungeons & Dragons as we know it. If you've ever tried to play the original Dungeons & Dragons, I hope your brain has a low THACO score. And if you know what that means, I'm sorry. Moving away from Dungeons & Magic and getting more into the sci-fi side of things, just a few years after Dungeons & Dragons came out, there is a game that came out called Traveler, which really pioneered the sci-fi RPG genre as we know it. Traveler was designed by Mark Miller, and it focused very hard on science fiction, like what they call hard science fiction, if that makes sense. And it featured interstellar trade, exploration, and politics. The game originally debuted as a boxed set of three small booklets known as the Little Black Books, which is kind of a weird way to deliver your RPG, but it's kind of fun too. Those books built the setting and the rules and the instructions for the setting known as the Third Imperium, which is what Traveler takes place in. The biggest thing that modern gaming took from Traveler is what is called life path character generation. And this is basically, instead of rolling stats and picking a class, you are rolling to see what happened to your character during their life before the game started.
Roll for trauma,
right? You're developing your character's backstory, because this is the first time that was the thing. Yeah. Your characters previously were just kind of, well, They didn't Here do I any. Am. They didn't exist before this.
Here I am. Right? I was born yeah. today.
And in this game specifically, you are not just creating that, you're rolling for it. My favorite part of this is that in Traveler, it is absolutely possible to die during character creation.
That's so yes. fucking funny.
I love it. Yeah. It's just one of the things that can happen to you. And then you just say, well, that happened. And now I'm going to build another character possibly related to that one. If they had a son or a daughter or something.
I always joke at D&D that I have a character with a similar name on the back burner. So I'm playing Jork into Peanuts right now. If she dies, it's going to be Crank and Mahog.
I love it. This life path character generation where you roll for stuff is, I think, best used in games like the Cyberpunk settings, which are amazing, by the way. Really, really cool role-playing games. And I highly recommend you look into Cyberpunk Red and that series of role-playing games if you're a fan of Cyberpunk. This sort of character generation, I think, is best used in a game called GURPS. Have you ever heard of GURPS?
I believe I have heard of GURPS. It's like G-U-R-P-S, right?
Yes. I have a book for GURPS on one of the bookshelves, I believe.
I was going to say, I thought, like, when I worked at the comic shop and we got in old collections, I swear to God, I saw someone sell a bunch of books. And I think I can picture the font. It's kind of a silly looking GURPS.
More modern GURPS is a little bit. The art, especially, is very silly. So GURPS stands for Generic Universal Role-Playing System. Or
yeah, that's what GURPS. It stands yeah. for. Yeah,
exactly. It's a tabletop role-playing game originally published by Steve Jackson of Munchkin and several other games that were very, very popular.
That's why I know GURPS so well, yes. too.
Oh, yeah. It was originally published in 1986 when, at the time, almost all systems were story or genre-specific. GURPS is not... You roll for everything. You roll to see what kind of creature you are, whether you are a caveman or a science blob, and whether you have a mustache, whether you... Everything. Everything is resolved by rolling 3 6-sided die.
I would love... I don't know if there's already an extant podcast. It's an actual play where someone's playing GURPS, but I feel like I need that.
You don't have to roll for everything. You can constrain it. That's why it's called Generic Universal, right? Because you can say, all right, these are the constraints. These are the available options.
But still,
I really like playing it where you just roll and see what you get.
The randomizer. Anything on, yeah. It's like, I'm Abraham Lincoln. This is my lesbian cave woman, bike riding wife with a 12-inch beard named Melinda.
Last time I played GURPS, I believe I ended up with a six-armed ooze person that was agoraphobic, I believe. GURPS is really, really fun. Even today, you should check it out. It's basically, if you are like, I like role-playing games, but I don't know what genre I want to play, I just want to have something that I can use to make my game, try GURPS. I think you'll enjoy it. In the 80s, we start to shift a little bit from combat and looting to investigation and mystery a little bit. Because that's when we start to get Call of Cthulhu from 1981. Oh, yeah. This game introduced the idea that fighting monsters was a terrible idea that would likely get you killed or driven mad, which I think is honestly pretty reasonable for the average person.
Yeah.
It introduced the concept of what is called onion skin, which it comes from animation, but it's basically saying interlocking layers of information and nested clues that lead the player to a certain conclusion, the truth of whatever is going on. It's a detective game. It uses something called Chaosium, which is a basic role-playing system. It relies on percentile dice to determine the outcomes. So let's say you have a 30% chance to do something. That means you have to roll 71 or higher on a 100-sided die to do it.
Oh, that's
yeah.
Odd.
Having played modern D&D, it's not as intuitive as I would think it would be, right? You would think saying, oh, if it's a 50% chance to happen, I have to get 51 or higher to, right?
Yeah.
But just That's flipping not a how coin.
It, yeah.
I prefer the multiple dice system that we have in D&D, but I respect and I understand when you have something that's very driven by realism and investigation. Granted, the Call of Cthulhu settings are not fully based in realism, of course, thank goodness. I understand the need for a percentile-based granular chance system for things.
Yeah, so. But I think, like, even Powered by the Apocalypse with 2d6s manages to...
True.
You know, with the partial success, complete success kind of thing, yeah. Still manages to be grounded in reality and keep it simpler, too. Yeah.
I think ultimately it comes down to preference and the reason for the granularity. In Call of Cthulhu, it is a notoriously difficult game to not die in. So,
well, any, I would imagine, yeah.
Yeah.
with my buddy Cthulhu involved, yeah.
Oh, yeah. They also added a sanity mechanic, which is kind of like a second health bar, basically, where you would slowly lose your sanity as you discover things in a dangerous fashion. If you did things particularly dangerously, you would lose your sanity. If you were exposed to things you shouldn't be exposed to in your investigation, you would lose sanity, and that would affect your ability to do other things. The game itself taught the games industry that being vulnerable and being a squishy little human amongst large, unknowable
Eldritch
entities,
yeah.
Right, could be just as fun as being a hero, a very powerful, invincible paladin with god powers. And I don't know if people give it enough credit for teaching people that, hey, being in a tough situation and coming out on top regardless can be interesting too, rather than a power fantasy. The last game that I want to talk about is one that came out much more recently, just the year before I was born, actually, Vampire the Masquerade.
I want to play this. I've never played it, and I feel like my vampire loving ass would be like, oh yeah, this is my shit.
Part of the reason I included it is because I think you would enjoy it. I think a good intro to that for you would be the Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines video game, I believe, which kind of is like they tried to take the board game and make it into a video game and did a decently good job of it, I should say. Huh. It's kind of like, if you've ever seen me play like Cyberpunk, it's that kind of game where you are a person running around in an open world setting. You can go drink people's blood, you build a character, you can be a Nosferatu style vampire or a sexy, cool, hot vampire, whatever you want. This was made in 1991, and it really abandoned the traditional heroics of D&D for what is called, or what was originally called, a game of personal horror set in a modern gothic punk world. Instead of hunting monsters, players were the monsters. Vampire the Masquerade was a lot simpler to play than other RPGs when it came out. It purposefully discarded a lot of the complex math of earlier games in favor of what you are more familiar with in terms of a dice pool system, essentially only using 10-sided dice. So it's more of a matter of how many dice do you roll rather than which dice do you roll. This was designed to aid a style of play emphasizing story over mechanics. Which,
I really think I would vibe with this one, because in D&D too, like when I've played with people who are min-maxers and we're all leveling up together, I make decisions for the love of the role play that I think are just more interesting story-wise, that they would be like, why would you do that? You should take this feat and do that and you'll optimize. And I'm like, David, I don't care about optimizing. I'm committed to the bit. Please.
We are doing collaborative storytelling.
I'm committed
not
to the
collaborative
bit.
Number crunching.
You optimize away, buddy. I'm going to do it for the joke.
Yeah. I think if you are a dungeon master or a D&D player, or if you play Pathfinder or anything like that nowadays and you're listening to this, I think the number one thing to take away from this is that in every sense, tabletop role-playing games have and always will be collaborative storytelling.
Yep.
It is ultimately that. And if you try to make it not that, it stops being fun.
It sucks.
Yeah, then it's just you are monologuing, right? You are just crunching numbers and monologuing, and that's not fun. It's just good to keep that in mind, right? You shouldn't be trying to win. I mean, try to win like your battles and stuff like
team.
That. But yeah, as a team, exactly.
As a team, yeah.
This game, Vampire the Masquerade, was developed by a guy named Mark Reinhagen. Rather than having like races and classes, like a lot of previous games were separated into, he set up a social structure in the game by dividing the vampires into 13 distinct clans based on their vampiric archetypes. So, like, what traits they have. So, like, the Nosferatu vampires are their own clan, essentially.
Oh.
That type of vampire. It's simple enough to play that you can just kind of jump into it and be like, yeah. Oh yeah, I'm a vampire and I roll these dice, and like, yeah, you don't have to understand armor class, or you don't have to saving throws, skill checks, you don't have to understand any of that to play Vampire the Masquerade. There are rules, of course,
but, there are rules, yeah, yeah, but yeah, this sounds loads of fun.
The last thing I want to talk about is why you probably shouldn't even play D&D. You should probably, if you're just getting into it, I would honestly play Pathfinder. Pathfinder is basically D&D, but it's a separate system created by people who left Wizards of the Coast and other previous owners of the D&D name and franchise. And they basically said, I think we could do a better job at this. We're going to make our own thing. So there's Pathfinder and Starfinder, the fantasy and sci-fi worlds, respectively. There is a first and now second edition of Pathfinder, and possibly even a third coming out at some point soon. First edition Pathfinder was actually the second RPG I ever played. The first thing I ever played or tried to play was AD&D.
Oh, Lord.
And that was, the math was too much for me. I was like 15. That friend was like, there's also this other game we could play called Pathfinder. And I was like, yeah, sure, let's do it. And that was a lot of fun. Pathfinder, again, very, very similar to D&D. You're using the same type of dice. The rules are very similar, but the mechanics are different. And I think, personally, Pathfinder does a better job at being accessible to any type of player. If you want to be a warrior that wields a shield in each hand, like my brother Matthew made one time, you can do that. And there are feats and skills that will accommodate you doing that successfully. You can do that. It's
That's
very,
silly.
Very flexible.
That's
yeah,
silly.
Yeah, yeah.
I like
you
that.
Can get very silly with it in Pathfinder. I really, really like Pathfinder. And if I had a group of people more willing to, not to say that you and James and the rest of the crew are not willing to learn Pathfinder, it's just like so close but different. I don't want to waste time with that. I know yeah. D&D, y'all know D&D, let's just play D&D. If I had a do-over, I would want to play Pathfinder more. I say that because the people who made D&D, some of them were real shitheads. Some of them were not. But the main guy that everyone talks about, Gary Gygax, was a real piece of shit.
Real awful piece of shit.
Let me just read you some quotes and give you some examples. In the original Greyhawk setting, which came after Blackmoor, it was the new setting for Dungeons and Dragons when it like more officially came out, and like AD&D and stuff like that, there was all kinds of different characters and enemies and stat tables listed for everything. Just one example. With dragons, you had lawful and neutral dragons, and then you had chaotic dragons and evil dragons. Lawful and neutral dragons had a king, and he had his own stat block. There's the king of lawful dragons, and then there's the queen of the chaotic or evil dragons. On its surface, maybe that's just a lore building thing, right?
Oh no, right? Not with the context I have about Mr. Gygax.
Well, he goes even further, because he puts a quote on the bottom of this stat table in the original Greyhawk setting that says, these additional varieties of dragons conform to the typical characteristics of their species, except where noted. There is only one king of lawful dragons, just as there is only one queen of chaotic dragons. Parentheses. Women's lib may make whatever they wish from the foregoing.
Oh, great.
Yeah. But here's the real nasty shit.
I'm wondering if you're going to bring up his opinions on the Trail of Tears.
I honestly didn't even have that in my notes. I was having trouble picking what to mention.
Yeah.
But this is... Yeah,
yeah, he's got a hot, surprise, racist, horrible take on the Trail mm-hmm. of Tears. Continue, yeah. though.
He's also a bioessentialist
yes.
who believes...
Well, believed. He's dead. He's believed. Listening Thank to you. This podcast from hell.
He believed that the ability to be creative and enjoy D&D was innate to men, and women could not play D&D. We were
That's
not smart
funny,
enough.
Because the least creative D&D players I've played with have almost universally been men.
Yeah. He literally said in a D&D public message board that women can't play D&D properly because our brains aren't built for it.
Well, mine's built for it tough. So yeah. Jot that down. Gygax.
Yeah. So in Europa Magazine, 1975, Gary Gygax left a quote. It's a fanzine, I should say. He said, "I have been accused of being a nasty old sexist male chauvinist pig, for the wording in D&D isn't what it should be. There should be more emphasis on the female role, more non-gendered names, and so forth. I thought perhaps these folks were right and considered adding women in the R-word and pillaging section, the whores and tavern wenches chapter, the special magical part dealing with hags and crones, and thought perhaps of adding an appendix on medieval harems, slave girls, and going Viking. Damn right I am sexist. It doesn't matter to me if women get paid as much as men, get jobs traditionally male, and shower in men's locker room. They can jolly well stay away from wargaming in droves for all I care. I've seen many a good wargame and wargamer spoiled thanks to the fair sex. I'll detail that if anyone wishes."
Gay.
Yeah. Do you even like women? Jesus Christ, dude. Yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah, Gary Gygax is a piece of shit. If you want to talk about the origins of D&D, talk about people like David Arneson and the people that made White Wolf games.
He didn't create D&D in a vacuum. There are people doing these things that created the bones that he kind of alchemized into D&D. But
exactly. He was just one shitty step in the process of getting to modern D&D. That's it. But for some reason, I think just because he's got a weird name, that is alliterative, he's the one everyone remembers and talks about for some reason. But he was a piece of shit. Not only that, dude had some kids. I'm going to say, Luke Gygax, you're cool. You are not anti-trans. You're cool, Luke Gygax. As I was preparing for this episode last week, 3 weeks prior, on February 28th, Ernie Gygax Jr. died.
Oh.
He was a shithead. He was anti-trans.
Wasn't he the one who's tried to start that TSR gaming separate game, the non-woke D&D that just was miserable?
So what happened was, back in like, I think the 90s, and this is all off the top of my head, not even in my notes, the D&D was originally published under TSR, Tactical Studies Rules. TSR was purchased by, I believe, Wizards of the Coast. And then when eventually the TSR name lapsed, their license to use that name expired, and they didn't renew it, a different person, not Ernie Gygax, said, "Oh, I am starting up a gaming business. That name lapsed. It's familiar. I should use that." So he did what he's legally allowed to do, started up a company called TSR Games, and started publishing role-playing games. Totally fine. Nothing wrong with that. Ernie Gygax said, "No, my family owned this name. My dad started this company, and you can't just steal the name like that." Originally, there was an agreement for Ernie Gygax, who was also starting up his own role-playing company, because he was going to call it TSR Games, and got mad that somebody beat him to the punch.
Yeah.
And then he discussed a licensing deal with the people that actually owned the license now. Midway through that, just started his own company, also called TSR Games. There was a big controversy about it. And this was like, I think, 5 years ago now.
More than that. I was still working at the comic book store.
Oh, yeah. Long time ago. But there was a big, big controversy about it, especially after when talking about everything that was going on with the TSR name and all of the games surrounding it. Because there's a lot of confusion between the two companies, literally with the exact same name, that are both doing the same thing. And there's a whole lawsuit going on and people don't know who's who. And then it gets worse because Ernie Gygax Jr. goes on an interview to talk about everything that's going on and makes a whole bunch of transphobic comments, basically saying that, yeah, us old heads don't want to play games that have more than two genders in them and stuff like that.
Yeah, his whole thing was, I'm making a game for the anti-woke crowd, the crowd who is angry that women can play D&D.
Exactly. Luke Gygax, from what I understand, if I recall, I believe he basically spoke out against Ernie and just said, "Hey, he's my brother, but like, I don't agree with that." So essentially, the licensing deal that was in the works and got really weird with the whole name stuff, because they started using the name before the licensing deal was done, that fell through. They basically said, "We're not going to work with you, Ernie. We support trans rights."
Yeah.
The website that Ernie Gygax started before he had the proper license, which is TSR.games. It's for sale.
How much?
$125.
That's all.
That's it. Yeah. I didn't do this. Someone hacked his old Twitter account and changed the bio to say trans rights are human rights. And deleted all the posts as well. So incredible. Now it just said, it, just says trans rights or human rights.
I'm assuming a trans woman did that because that's very trans femme coded to do. Yeah. So if you're out there, babe, good job.
Mwah, I love you. Good work. Again, was not me. I cannot take credit for
that. Okay.
No, it was not.
I know it wasn't you.
No, but so that's how we get to modern tabletop role-playing games.
Well, I love it. And I love you. And I love playing tabletop role-play games. I really think if you are autistic and listening and you've never tried, if you can get a group of people together, it is one of those social things that does not take my social battery as much.
Yeah.
Because there is so much structure and everything. Like, the type of communication we're doing is not, like, rigid, but I'm given directions. I'm told, you know, these are the confines you can work in. And my autism fucking loves it. It's not like when I go to a normal board game night and I have to quell homicidal rage when it's someone's turn and they won't stop fucking talking. They won't fucking shut up and it's their turn. I just want them to go next so I can end this game of Settlers of Catan. It's not like that because everyone's involved and, like, interacting. I love tabletop roleplay games. I'm still in the back of my mind think that Violet should DM a actual play podcast with me. I think that would be fun. But that there are lots really of good fun. Ones. And if you have trouble with math, I mentioned Powered by the Apocalypse system. It's just two regular D6 dice. There are lots of games that run on it, like Blades in the Dark and Monster of the Week. Really, really good games. And for me with Dyscalculia, that also takes so much off of my mental plate as far as playing, because I just have to worry about at most like 6 dice that are going to just have 1 through 6 on them. You know what I mean? Depending on how high you get the character, it's much easier for my brain. There's much less to think about.
If you are new to tabletop role-playing games and you want to get into them and you are intimidated by the rules, I highly recommend just look up, do a search online for one-page RPGs.
Yeah.
And these are basically games where they've simplified the rules to the extent that it's one piece of paper that has all the rules you need to play. Boom, go. Some of these can be really, really fun, and some of them can be really, really funny, too. I think the most funny one I've ever played, I forget what it's called. I think it's something called, like, I am not the ghost of Jonathan Frakes or something like that.
Frakes is alive.
Oh, I know. That's part of the joke.
Oh.
Yeah. If we have time, let me look this up really quick. Hold on. Ah, it's called Jonathan Frakes Wants Your Attention and You Must Not Give It to Him. So one player is the ghost of Jonathan Frakes and the other is haunted by the ghost of Jonathan Frakes. The haunted player, you, are doing house chores for real. And the other player is trying to get your attention as the ghost of Jonathan Frakes. If you successfully get the other person to acknowledge your existence while they're doing the chores in some way, you can't touch them. You're a ghost. You can't touch them. But if you get them to acknowledge your existence, the roles then reverse and you lose. The ghost wins and the roles are then reversed.
I may use this for work to help people get over executive function issues with chores.
Really?
Yeah, like, you gamify it like this, you get a couple who's actually excited to fucking do dishes because they get to play the Jonathan Frakes game and switch back and forth.
Heck yeah, honestly.
Like, no, this is like, game. I'm thinking about it through my work goggles and I'm like, oh, this could gamify something to make it more reasonable for someone to do. You have a partner with you and it's like, all right, do the Riker maneuver on that chair, let's distract, and then we swap.
It's a really funny game. It's really funny to play and fun to play. And it was developed by Jeff Stormer. It came out in 2023. I actually got the game. It's a one pager, right? One page rules thing. Very, very simple. And it's slightly more complicated than what I explained. But the game itself is very fun. Get yourself a little
Jonathan
Frakes action.
We're going to pick a chore and we're going to play that because I need to test it for work. Hey friends, before I get to thanking our Patreon supporters, I'd like to make you aware of a mutual aid opportunity. If you go to the show details, you'll find a link to our Balana Arts merch hub, and in our merch hub, you will find the Fuck Ice sticker designed by Violet. And 100% of the proceeds from this sticker go to mutual aid here in the Minneapolis area. Minneapolis is still really struggling after Operation Metro Surge. There are still ICE agents taking people away. They're just sneakier about it now. And a lot of our neighbors have not been safe to leave their home for quite a good amount of time and are struggling to pay rent. They have work they've missed. They have legal fees. They have all of these things that they have to worry about that they shouldn't have to worry about in the first place. And the people of Minneapolis need support. So if you want to help our neighbors out, you can go to the show details, go find the link to the Balana Arts merch hub, and you will find the Fuck Ice sticker that Violet has designed on the merch hub. I post whenever we make a donation after we get a good chunk in. I just posted one recently of $44 we were able to donate to KNMN, which is a mutual aid organization here in the Minneapolis area, a coalition really that helps get people the supplies they need to live. So if you go check out the show details, you can find that sticker and help support my neighbors. And now I'd like to thank our Patreon supporters, like Jennifer, Patch, Harlene, Bethany, Laura Kramer, Lilith Rain, Janice Weston, Anarchista, Percy, Nanya B, Kate Michigoose, K-Genius, Chips1012, Dave Peril, Megan E, Carl Brooks, Natasha Neves, Gus Lutzi, Helen Clifford, Sewing Seraph, Rachel Rachelson, and Vintago. You know the deal. If you want to help us out, you can tell other people about the show. We don't take paid advertisements, and we don't pay for advertising, because that's expensive. We don't want to do it, and we'd rather spend money making the shows better. So the way you can help us is by telling other people about the show, because we grow entirely by word of mouth. It's the easiest way to help us. You post about it, tell an individual friend, do just literally whatever you can to tell other people about Info Dumpies and Mixnomer in general, if you like, you know, more than one of our shows. You want to help us out even further, you can subscribe on your podcatcher of choice. You can leave a rating, review, or a nice comment on your podcatcher of choice, whatever they support. The more action we get on those podcatchers, the more we can get promoted on their algorithms and shown to people who like similar shows. And that's another way you can help people, new people, find the stuff we make. If you're in a place to help us out financially, you can go to the show details and you will find a link to the Mixnomer Patreon page. And the Mixnomer Patreon page is for everything Mixnomer has done, will do, is currently doing. And you get bonus material based on your tier on Patreon for anything we're doing. Tiers start at just $1, and it's a great way to support what we do. It goes towards, you know, hosting fees and equipment and sound design stuff. I'm working on sound design for the sci-fi show that is not out yet, and I'm, you know, having to go occasionally buy some weird stuff to make spaceship noises. So the money that you all give us on Patreon, a portion of that goes to getting things to make shows better. It goes to the cast of the audio dramas. Everyone's getting paid, and you help us be able to devote more time to working on these shows. And if you want to hang out with us, you can also go to the show details to find a link to the Discord server. The Discord server is great. Just the greatest gang of people. It's very welcoming. It is just the most supportive place. Just real certified sweethearts. So if you want to hang out with us, we do streams pretty regularly. A couple weeks ago, I played the Buffy game for Xbox from 2002 on a stream, and that was pretty fun. Next weekend, Violet will be playing a game called Funny Raccoon Game, which is as fun as it sounds. It's a funny raccoon game. But anyway, you want to hang out with us, go check out a link to the Discord server in the show details. That's all I've got for you this time, my friends. Until next time, clever sign off.